We're live with Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Jared Hill, in for Steve Chiatakis.
We are getting displaced. Many of us are low-income people. Many of us are low-income seniors.
Affordable housing is a big problem, particularly here in Southern California. Well, now it looks like California will become the third state this year, after New York and Oregon, to put in place a statewide rent control rule.
At this time, one-third of all renters pay more than half of their income toward rent. Rental housing affordability is outpacing income growth at a level that is simply unsustainable.
That's David Chu, the state assemblyman from San Francisco, who is behind AB 1482, the bill passed by the state legislature yesterday that caps the amount by which many landlords can raise the rent at 5% plus inflation. Governor Newsom says he'll sign it. The bill passed, although Democrats were divided and all Republicans voted no. And of course, there's plenty of debate about the pros and cons of rent control, or rent stabilization, as some people call it. To help us understand some of the viewpoints and how we can be affected by these here in these laws here at Greater LA, I'm joined by Daniel Uchelson, executive director of the Apartment Association of Greater LA. His organization advocates for landlords and housing developers and opposes this bill. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for being here. I'm also joined by Cynthia Strathman, Executive Director of Strategic Actions for a Just Economy. Her organization advocates for tenants' rights and supports this bill. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Cynthia, I want to come to you first. The city of LA has rent control rules in place already. How is this new state law different? Are there Angelenos who are currently not covered by it that will be covered under this new law?
Yes, there are more people who will be covered who are not previously covered. So, for instance, previously, if a building had been built after October of 1978, it wouldn't have been covered. But this law will cover a whole bunch of other buildings because it only exempts the last 15 years. And this is hoped will prevent the disincentivization of new construction, but it will provide protections for a lot of tenants who weren't previously covered.
So LA City and County obviously has a big housing affordability and homelessness crisis going on. Do you think this bill will make a significant difference? And if so, in what ways?
Well, I think it will make a difference that's significant for the people that it covers, because right now for a lot of tenants, they just don't have any protections at all. They can be evicted for absolutely no reason. They can see enormous rent hikes, hundreds of percent over what they're currently paying, and they have really no protections at all. And so for those folks who are very, very vulnerable, it will help protect them. You know, is it going to totally solve the housing crisis? No, I don't think it will. I mean, we really do need a lot more protections for tenants in the future, but I think this is certainly a step in the right direction.
Understood. I want to play a piece of sound from David Chu again, the San Francisco assemblyman who is the main author of the bill.
A recent study from the University of Southern California projects triple-digit rent increases to hit much of the Southern California region over the next 2 years.
So, Daniel, I'm sure you agree that we have a big housing affordability problem in LA, but you don't like this bill. Tell us why.
Well, it's not going to solve the problem. You know, the reason we're in the situation we're in with all the housing shortages and rents increasing for the very few units that do become available for people to rent is all this regulation. It's forcing property owners out of business. Over 70% of the property of the rental housing providers in the state of California are small mom and pops who saved, you know, put their life savings into these properties in hopes that someday it would help supplement their retirement. And they're literally being forced out of business with all this regulation, all this red tape, and a lot of lost opportunity because they're subject to all these price controls. And price controls never work. You know, rent control was only meant to be a temporary fix. It was something that the U.S. government experimented with during the two world wars, and it was just meant to be temporary. But here, 40 years later of rent control, you know, we have some of the worst housing shortages here in Los Angeles. We have rents that are rising for few units that become available, and we have the absolute worst homeless situation. And you see that time and again in other cities like Santa Monica and San Francisco and Berkeley. With all these strict regulations, they've just made matters worse. And it's the law of unintended consequences that has come into play. And this passage of this AB 1482 is not going to provide any incentives whatsoever to do what we need to do in the state, and that's build more housing, particularly affordable housing. It's just too expensive to build in the state with all the regulation, all the fees that get tacked on. It costs nearly $700,000 to build one rental housing unit. And in fact, you know, the Wall Street Journal came out today with an article, and they called AB 1482 the world's dumbest housing policy, and that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
You know, we are not going to get ourselves out of this situation until we build more housing for people to live in.
So, Cynthia, in addition to being an advocate for tenants' rights, you are also a landlord. Is that right?
Yeah.
How do you balance those two things? Are they sometimes in conflict, being a landlord and also and fighting for tenants' rights?
No, not really, because if you're a good landlord, then the rules that we're advocating for tenants aren't really going to affect you at all. I mean, somebody said that what this bill does actually is codifies good landlord behavior. You know, you can be a landlord and you can completely meet all of your costs without having to raise the rents on a tenant by 50%. You know, I've never done it. Most landlords never do it. Most mom and pop landlords never do it. The only reason that, you know, anyone is kind of defending the right to, you know, hand astronomical rent increases onto tenants is because they're greedy and they want to make a huge amount of money. That's it, period. That is the only reason you need to do that. So I think the argument that somehow this is all about moms and pops is really disingenuous, because it's not. It's about really big landlords and really big corporations who want to be able to gouge tenants for as much as they can get out of them.
Daniel, I want to... go ahead.
Anyway, to just conclude, I don't think it's actually a conflict at all. You know, I've never given anybody... inflation is almost, nothing right now, and the cost of living increases haven't been particularly high, so I don't really see why you would have to actually give anybody a really huge rent increase in order to stay in business as a small mom and pop landlord.
Daniel, I want to know, assuming this bill is signed by the governor, which we expect he will, California will be the third state this year to impose new rent control rules after New York and Oregon. This new rent control rule expires after 10 years. How does that make you feel? Does it make you feel a little bit better about it, or how do you feel?
I just think it'll get extended after 10 years. The sunset clause is just nothing that we can enforce. And so I think that would eventually get extended. So the 10-year sunset clause really means nothing to me, just like the amount of the rent increase really means nothing, because it's only going to get ratcheted down from there. The city of San Francisco started at a much higher annual increase, and that just got ratcheted down and ratcheted down to now it's around 2% a year or less that owners are allowed to increase their rents. And so it's just not going to really work for people. And, you know, I take issue with painting landlords in a bad light. We are not in the eviction business. That's the last resort for any property owner. We are in the customer service business. We want to keep our tenants in place. And only the evictions only cost us money. They cost money in attorney's fees, lost rent, and also rehabbing the unit. So owners will tell you they do everything, absolutely everything in their power to keep their tenants in place. And I know the tenant groups like to paint us as bad actors, but it's absolutely not true. We want to house people. We're in the business of housing people. That's why we've made these investments in our community, so we can be there and house our neighbors. And that's the reason we exist.
Okay, so I'm short on time here. Cynthia, one of the arguments against rent control is that it paints too broad a brush. In other words, rich or middle-income people have as much right to live in a rent-controlled apartment as poor people. Wouldn't it be better to target rent help just to the low-income people who really need it? Cynthia?
I mean, I think that I'm all for always trying to level the playing field and help low-income people if we can. But, you know, I think there's another argument here, which is that as a landlord, and, you know, I am a landlord, I, you know, get a certain amount of benefit from being able to make an investment in property. And that comes with a certain obligation to the rest of society. And I don't think that obligation necessarily stops, you know, just at low-income people, because this isn't really about charity. It's about fairness. It's about making sure that people aren't being taken advantage of, even middle class people, by having to pay, you know, really exorbitant rents to somebody just because, you know, that person feels like they can get away with it.
Finally, Daniel, in just the last seconds I have here, do you see any positives from this bill for that you can be happy about?
I don't see anything that's positive about it. You know, as an owner, I want to be part of the housing solution. The members of our association want to be a part of the solution to figure out the housing crisis here in California. side, okay. Providing more regulation, enforcing more regulation isn't a solution. It won't do one bit good.
All right. Daniel Yukelson is the executive director of the Apartment Association of Greater LA. Cynthia Strathman is the executive director of Strategic Actions for a Just Economy. Thank you so much, both. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Coming up, we've got Hong Kong and D.C. that may be mortal enemies at the moment, but China and California.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
California are collaborating in more ways than one. This is KCRW's Greater LA. This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jared Hill. Tensions between China and the U.S. are rising, rife with trade wars and combative speeches. But China and California, on the other hand, are building deep, interdependent relationships from film and TV to housing and development. And we're seeing it all play out on our screens and in our streets. Matt Sheehan is the author of the new book called The Trans-Pacific Experiment, How China and California Collaborate and Compete for Our Future. Hey, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. So where did this book start for you? Why did you write this book?
Yeah, so in many ways, I kind of stumbled into it. I was living over in China beginning in 2010, and I wanted to work as a journalist there. But when I finally got that journalist job, the Chinese government didn't want to give me a journalist visa. Mm. And so I ended up spending about 7 or 8 months back in my hometown of Palo Alto in the Bay Area as a quote-unquote China correspondent, but living out there. And so at first I felt very cut off from everything that was happening in China. I thought I was going to lose my Mandarin and lose track of all these threads I'd been tracing over there as a journalist. And then I realized that a lot of those threads were coming to me. They were coming to me in the form of Chinese homebuyers coming to my hometown. They were coming to me in terms of seeing all the Chinese technologists who were coming to Silicon Valley, learning skills and maybe going back to China to found startups, the Chinese students at the universities around me. And so I very much by chance just stumbled into a lot of these storylines and spent the last 5 years basically tracing them back and forth from California back to China and back to California and watched as they developed and led to, yeah, new possibilities, but also a lot of new tensions.
How would you describe the relationship between these two places right now?
The relationship between China and California, it's been on something of a different track than the broader U.S.-China relationship. While the broader U.S.-China story is often sort of very high-level politics, it's at this moment very tense. It tends to be about the sort of the exchange of goods. You know, we send them money, they send us back cheap goods. Whereas the China-California story is much more sort of down to earth. I think of it as grassroots international diplomacy. So you have a lot of Chinese students who have showed up at California campuses. You have a lot of Chinese technologists in Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley technologists looking to China. The same thing here in Hollywood, in real estate, across a whole bunch of different dimensions. And I think when you bring that national level relationship down to the ground level, it really changes things. In many ways, it sparks new opportunities for kind of cultural fusion and interesting collaboration, but it also brings a lot of new tensions when you bring these people face to face.
Let's look at the relationship between China and Hollywood more specifically. You write that the Chinese box office has more than quintupled in the past decade, which is kind of mind-blowing. How does this large Chinese audience impact the movies that we make here in Hollywood and how film executives make those decisions?
Yeah, Hollywood executives have for a long time now, about a decade, they've been looking to China as kind of the great hope on the horizon, something that while the box office here is stagnating or even declining, the Chinese box office is functionally making up the difference. Mm-hmm. And you have major franchises like The Fast and the Furious or Avengers, where even if those movies were to bomb here in the U.S., they might get bailed out by Chinese audiences. Mm-hmm. So that reliance means that Hollywood has to do everything it can to stay in that market and to keep pleasing Chinese consumers.
Talk more specifically about big films and how they've played overseas and how that's been good for the studios.
Films like the Transformers franchise, a lot of times you'll see the executives or the scriptwriters functionally make the story take a turn towards China. Suddenly, the entire storyline will be transported to Hong Kong and we'll have scenes over there. That's because in order to make sure these movies get into the Chinese market, they have to ensure a certain amount of Chinese elements in them, what makes it what's called a co-production. So the Chinese government lets it enter the market. But also they will trim anything that is deemed potentially politically sensitive. So you'll have scenes in which, say, a Chinese doctor saves Iron Man, or you'll have scenes in which the Chinese military, you know, springs into action in a Transformers film. But functionally, you can think of it as we won't see a major studio release a major film in which China is cast in a negative light for a long time, like with the Bond franchise. It would make perfect sense right now for the next Bond villain to be Chinese. This generally reflects our geopolitics over time. They used to be, you know, Soviet bad guys. And you'd think today maybe that bad guy would be Chinese. But there is little to no chance that a Bond movie will feature a Chinese villain for a very, very long time.
You visited the rural town of Hengdian, which bills itself as the Hollywood of China. What's it like there? And does it at all reflect the films being made here in L.A.?
Yeah, Hengdian is a fascinating place because though it bills itself as the Hollywood of China, it demonstrates a totally different approach to what makes movies happen. In Hengdian, what they did is they actually built life-size, full-scale replicas of a ton of ancient landmarks in China. So a life-size, full-scale replica of the Forbidden City, a full-scale replica of this ancient Qin Palace, all these sort of stereotypical scenes that are frequently featured in Chinese movies. And they figured they kind of took a if-you-build-it-they-will-come approach.
Interesting.
They built the sets, they built the hardware that's needed to make movies, and they said, you know, come here, film your movies as you want. They take a very much more grounded and kind of hardware-based approach to making movies. They think if you have the sets, you have the cameras, and you throw together a certain number of actors and directors, eventually creativity and artistry will emerge from that. In the U.S., we tend to think of these things as kind of beginning from an abstract or an ethereal concept, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And we think that once you have that, the sort of creativity can burst from anyone. Whereas in China, they really try to build it from the ground up, and Hengdian, in many ways, represents that.
Okay, so let's move from Hollywood to downtown L.A., where we've seen a lot of new developments going up in the past decade. A lot of those developments are being funded by Chinese millionaires and billionaires. Why is that?
So over the past 5 to 10 years, you saw a major outflow of Chinese capital, and that was both at the sort of personal level, wealthy families who wanted to move their own money outside of China, and also at the corporate level, major Chinese development companies that had in many ways gotten rich by building up Chinese cities, suddenly wanting to move some of that money overseas. That was, on the personal level, it was oftentimes about wanting to immigrate. They wanted their kids to maybe be raised in Palo Alto or in Los Angeles, somewhere with clean air and good schools, something like that. For the companies, it was often more of a risk diversification strategy. The Chinese economy is always looking a little bit creaky. And they thought, you know, if you've got $50 billion, why not plant $1 billion of it down here in L.A.? Mm-hmm. And Chinese companies tend to put their money into real estate. It's seen as a very stable asset. So some of them bought up major plots in downtown L.A. and started building towers like Metropolis. And the families bought homes in the suburbs.
One of the mega projects in DTLA, you just mentioned Metropolis, that's pretty huge. It's over by the Staples Center. Who's behind that and what's happening there?
So that's the Greenland Group, or Greenland USA. It's one of the largest developers in China, and it's a state-owned enterprise. Some industry folk described it to me as basically another wing of the Shanghai city government. And they bought that land and started building these towers, some of them luxury condos and some of them a sort of more boutique hotel. And it sort of has the dual purpose of, one, taking a lot of money outside of China and putting it in U.S. dollars, and two, sort of putting your stamp on a very valuable and prestigious market. Mm. The idea being that if you can sell luxury condos to people in L.A., then your main market, your main customer base back in China will say, wow, you know, Greenland Group, they're in L.A., and they're sort of good enough for me out here in Chongqing or Xi'an.
Mm-hmm. There's something ominous about that.
Yeah, I guess when you put it that way, it does seem a bit ominous. And on some level, we've been through this before. This is what was happening in many cases in the 80s when Japan was sort of at the height of its own economic boom. And they similarly, they bought up things like Pebble Beach. They bought up major trophy properties in New York. And at the time, there was a fear that, you know, the Japanese are coming. They're going to take over our economy in some way. And in some way, those fears are rooted in some reality that, you know, we don't want to just start auctioning off our prized assets to international investors just because we want to make a quick buck. But there's also always other elements to this. We tend to react very differently if the buyers are Asian, East Asian, Chinese, Japanese, than probably if the buyer were a French conglomerate or even, you know, a Italian conglomerate. I think that there's definitely another element and another layer to that.
Wealthy Chinese investors are not only funding big projects, they're buying big houses, especially in the Bay Area and here in LA. How does that impact local housing supply, but also housing affordability? Because we're obviously seeing like skyrocketing prices, especially in the Bay Area and in LA. How does that have an impact?
Yeah, this is very close to home for me. I grew up mostly in Palo Alto, and it was one of the main sort of targets of Chinese buyers coming in and buying these luxury houses. And in 2013, I actually went on a sort of a luxury home buying tour with a group of Chinese tourists. There were so many coming in that local real estate companies would actually rent a bus, sort of drive them around town from property to property, and they'd put down their bids, often all cash. So in the wealthy and relatively prestigious suburbs of both LA and of San Francisco, you do see some upward pressure on prices from Chinese home buyers, specifically in the very wealthy suburbs. But there's also some countervailing forces. In San Francisco and also down here in LA, you had Chinese money ending up funding some of the larger affordable housing developments and just the larger mega developments that ended up bringing a lot of units onto the market and in that way, hopefully increasing supply and bringing down prices. So in San Francisco, that was up in Hunters Point. The largest mega development there sort of got off the ground because of Chinese investor money. And in LA, we've seen similar things downtown and other places. So in some cases, you have these countervailing forces driving up the prices in the very wealthy suburbs while also bringing on a lot of new units in the downtown areas and hopefully at least bringing down prices at the middle or lower end of the market.
When you think about the interdependency of China and California and then also China and the United States, are you hopeful or worried? How do you kind of frame that in your mind?
I would say that I'm both hopeful and worried. I think I'm worried because at a national level, you see these two countries and these two economies both wrenching apart from each other and also building in very serious distrust that goes across a whole range of industries, technology, trade policy, and stuff like film even. But I'm also hopeful when I really zoom in and look at some of the grassroots issues. I look at the Chinese students who have come here, gotten their education here, or I know from my own friends, people that I met over in China or that I've met back here in California, just how transformative time spent in another country can be for someone's entire world. It can really open up new worlds. And I see that a lot of times when I talk to young Chinese people who have come to the U.S. and spent time here. So while I'd say things are very, very rocky and potentially even dangerous in the near term, I do have some hope that over time, we're going to see these seeds that have been planted in the last few years, the seeds that have been planted here in California and back in China, come to fruition and hopefully build a more productive relationship between the places.
Matt Sheehan's new book is called The Trans-Pacific Experiment, How China and California Collaborate and Compete for Our Future. Thanks so much, Matt. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, want to remind you one more time, today's the last day of our two-day incentive for the Undrive Pledge Drive. So here's the deal. If we raise $25,000 by midnight tonight, your pledge gets matched dollar for dollar, courtesy of KCRW board member Dylan Yule. So we really appreciate him for that. So that's a perfect time for you to be able to increase your support, give an additional gift, and make your dollars go twice as far for the station that you love here at KCRW. I'm talking to you, like, no, you know, you, specifically you. What are you waiting for? Make sure to go to kcrw.com/join or give us a call at 800-600-KCRW. This is my last day here. I want to thank the whole team here across all of KCRW for showing me such a great time these last few weeks. Most specifically, the GLA team, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, PJ Shahamat, and Christian Bordal. You're all the best. I can't sing your praises in the right key, otherwise I would. But there is a cake for you in the newsroom, I promise. You can catch all things Greater LA online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. The podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts and the KCRW app. As for me, you can find me on Twitter and on the Instagram machine at Jarrett Hill. I also host a daily politics and pop culture show called Drop the Subject, weekdays at 10 a.m. over on the new channel Q and at radio.com. Michael Silverblatt and the best theme song on the radio are coming up next. It's Bookworm. Steve Chiotakis will be back in the seat on Monday. I'm Jarrett Hill. As my mom would say, if you see someone without a smile, give them one of yours. Bye-bye.